Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Happy to be with you tonight, and glad you decided to spend some time with us on this holiday weekend. Memorial Day is, of course, about more than barbecues and parades. It's our most thoughtful holiday, honoring those who made the ultimate sacrifice to preserve our freedoms and our way of life. Hope you take a moment to think about the meaning of this three-day weekend sometime over the next couple of days. I'm here both tonight and tomorrow night and thought we would have some fun by exploring some of the core issues, the core subjects around which this program was created. As we near the official beginning of the summer, the movie blockbuster season has already begun, and several of the films that are coming soon to a mega multiplex near you will be about aliens or ETs, monsters in space, time travel. The spookier aspects about life in the universe and the nature of reality itself. And that's the ground we're going to cover tonight. Alien-themed movies are, seems like they're always good for business. The best of them have made piles of money. A few have even been critical successes as well. Close Encounters of the Third Kind comes to mind. E.T. the Extraterrestrial. The original War of the Worlds. What is the nature of this seemingly symbiotic relationship between Hollywood and alien themes? Is someone trying to tell us something? Or is it merely a function of dollars and cents? One of my guests tonight has pursued this topic as an academician. He's a scholar now working on a doctorate that will focus on these very questions, and he's written extensively to suggest that something more is going on, that Hollywood keeps making these kinds of movies for reasons other than boffo box office, that maybe they're trying to tell us something. Coming up in the second half of the program tonight, Robbie Graham of the UK, who's written some terrific stuff about the Hollywood ET connection. He was here once before with George Norrie. We thought it might be time to bring him back and find out what new themes he's exploring. Should be a lot of fun. But first, we look at efforts to produce a movie about a giant in the field of alien abduction research, a brilliant man of science who became intrigued by these strange reports. He wrote a book based on, actually he wrote two books, based on the accounts of 200 abductees and their families, people he interviewed and researched. And he faced down scorn and ridicule, the kind of stuff that sort of invariably follows that kind of research. He was investigated by a secret committee and was in danger of losing his tenure at Harvard for daring to look into this topic. But he fought back, and he struck a blow for academic freedom. And I think he struck a blow for the subject matter itself. We can only imagine where this topic would be had Dr. John Mack's life not been cut short. And now there is a movie in the works based on his private papers that have never been made public. Of course, if you know anything about Hollywood, you know nothing is ever easy in the movie biz. Producer Denise David Williams will be joining me in a few minutes to tell us about John Mack's work, her own efforts to bring his story to the big screen. So it's sort of movie night here on Coast to Coast, and I think you'll find both of these guests to be highly engaging. First, a couple of news notes. Are you following the story about the bloody rampage in Santa Barbara County in Southern California? Police now have seen a YouTube video posted by the emotionally troubled gunman and in which he vows a day of retribution. Certainly seems like that's what he did. 22-year-old Elliot Roger went on a killing spree that ended Friday night when he took his own life. He stabbed to death three men in his residence. Then he went and shot two women, killed them outside a sorority house. Then he shot and killed another man at a deli. Then he took his own life while he was sitting inside his wrecked car. 13 other people were injured during this rampage in which he had, I think, two different shootouts with police. Police say this guy had 400 rounds of ammunition in the car along with three handguns, so I suppose it could have been even worse. The YouTube video that's now in the hands of police and being analyzed shows Roger on a rant about how he's been badly treated by women ever since puberty. He'd been a community college student, and we're told that his father works in the movie industry. Tragic story there. Wildfires in Alaska have scorched more than 70,000 acres in the past couple of days. CNN reporting tonight 78,000 acres have been consumed by flames burning in a national wildlife refuge. And as of this afternoon, the fire was only 20% contained. In Arizona, more of the same. Fires forced the evacuation of more than 3,000 people near Flagstaff. Firefighters did make good progress today. Nearly 1,000 of them involved in battling this blaze, trying to save some 300 homes and businesses threatened by the flames. More than 8,500 acres have been blackened so far. This area, I am told, it's between Flagstaff and Sedona, and I know we have a lot of coast listeners in that area. Hope you're all safe and secure. Webmaster Sean and I put together an assortment of items, news items, and oddities. You can find them on the Coast website under Naps News. You know, we're all aware we're under a lot of surveillance these days. Someone's always listening to our phone calls, recording, or stashing our emails, but this article struck me as kind of a bridge too far. It's about how Facebook can monitor what music you listen to, what TV shows you watch, by listening through your smartphone. Your smartphone has a microphone in it, and they can listen to whatever you're doing and sort of figure out what your preferences are. Also, is it possible to create a drug that will help you fall out of love? Call it the anti-love potion number 9. We have a piece on that. Also, the great John Steinbeck, one of my favorite writers, wrote an impassioned plea to create an agency, sort of like NASA, except this agency would study the oceans. We have the words that Steinbeck wrote a long time ago. And we posted a recent article from a Boston newspaper that sets up the interview to come about the late Dr. John Mack and a possible movie about his life. Check that out in our Naps News section on the Coast website when you get a moment, because we're going to jump right now. We're going to jump into that topic, rather, right after our first break. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. The late Dr. John Mack was not the only academic to take on the issue of alien abductions. There's a guy named Dr. Leo Sprinkle who did some of the earliest work. That was, I think it was back in the 60s. Of course, Dr. David Jacobs picked up the torch. He's been our guest on this program many times. But Dr. Mack is certainly the most esteemed academic to jump into the deep end of the pool. Harvard Med School is sort of top of the academic heap, after all. Dr. Mack's 1994 book about alien abductions rippled through the scientific community with sometimes shocking effect, so much of it negative. But Dr. Mack stood his ground, and I'm proud to say that I knew him. I met him a couple times, interviewed him. I used statements and sound bites from him in documentaries and also in a book. He was a brilliant man, and in more ways than one, courageous as well. He won a Pulitzer Prize for a book he wrote about Lawrence of Arabia. When it comes to abductions, he was really on to something. I mean, his thinking went far beyond the mere allegations of the abductions, the circumstance of these experiences in a physical sense, as described by the abductees, the stories told by the people who say they were victimized. It went to the heart of reality itself. What is reality? How we fit in? As I mentioned, there are plans to bring Dr. Mack's story to the big screen. Producer Denise David Williams secured the rights to the story from the Mack family and was initially met by great enthusiasm in Hollywood, but she's since run into roadblocks. She joins me now to talk about Dr. Mack and his work and her ideas for the film. Denise, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled you're here. I can't wait to get into this. You have some, I read your resume, you have some experience working on blockbuster movie projects, at least one that involved aliens. Tell us a little bit about your film work.
Well, after I graduated from USC Graduate School in Film, I had a series of jobs in the industry that exposed me to incredible writers and directors. My very first job, I was an intern on ET, and I was like a fly on the wall.
Oh my gosh.
And then I had a series of executive jobs at 20th Century Fox and a company called IndieProd, and my job was to find material for domestic and foreign markets, and I was also vice president of a company called Copelson Entertainment, and we produced Platoon, which won an Academy Award for Best Picture and Best Director, as a matter of fact. So I do have experience in the business, and I've worked with some amazingly talented people.
Lucasfilm, you were at Lucasfilm there for a while?
Yeah, that was my, right out of film school, I was at Lucasfilm, and they were doing Raiders, and they were developing E.T., and it was all under one umbrella.
My gosh, yeah. That's a heck of a place to start.
Yeah, it was.
So how did you come across the story of John Mack?
Well, it was actually quite synchronistic. My ears started ringing one day out of the blue. It was very odd. And I know this sounds strange, but they started ringing, and I started to get this message in my head very clearly, an intuitive thought, to go to this store in Glendale and just to go to the back of this metaphysical bookstore. And I went, and once I got there, I met this woman who told me the story about John Mack. And she had been a patient of John's. She was an abductee from childhood. And she had tried to get the attention of people in Hollywood and was never successful. And we were brought together. And as soon as she told me the story of John, I literally had goosebumps because it just seemed to be the perfect intersection for me of an incredible, a story that would make an incredible film, incredible protagonist. And also the subject matter that John was working in was something that I felt that I understood. And then I felt that I would be a great champion for him. And so I went on this search. I mean, I researched him, and then I tracked down his family members. He has three sons and an ex-wife. And it took me about 4.5 years to gain their trust, to convey to them that my intentions were sincere and that I wanted to tell a story that would do honor to John Mack, to basically pick up the torch and continue his work through a motion picture, and that his legacy would be commensurate with who he was and what he did and the price that he paid. So that was about a 4.5 year process. And it had only been a year since John had died. So to have someone knocking on their door from Hollywood saying, hey, we want to make a motion picture, you can imagine from their point of view how, you know, that was not something that they were interested in.
But had anyone else been there already?
Not that they know of. Not that I know of. And
right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so emotions are still raw. It's still an open wound at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you win them over?
Well, it was a lot of patience, a lot of perseverance, and sincerity, to tell you the truth, because I really was very sincere in protecting John Mack's legacy and ensuring that the story would be told in the classiest way possible and in the most authentic way and in a way that conveyed what John was saying, you know, beyond, I guess we'll get into that, but he really took it where no researcher had taken the subject before.
Well, let's do that here now. Let's talk about it. We'll come back to the movie, especially some of the new material that has not been made public. We'll come back to that a little bit later, but let's talk about Dr. Mack and his work. You know, he's been gone a few years now. There may be many in our audience who are not familiar with him. Why don't you tell us the broad strokes? Why he was such an unusual and brilliant man, and why it makes such a great topic for a movie.
Sure. So Dr. Mack was an esteemed Harvard psychiatrist. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He was world-renowned. He was a scientist. He was a very left-brained, materialistic, worldview kind of guy. He was an atheist. And he was attending a workshop with a psychiatrist named Stanislav Grof. And Stan gave John a chapter in a forthcoming book that was called Alien Encounters as a Crisis of Transformation. And he asked for John's opinion. And John read it, and it was somewhat interesting to him, but he basically dismissed it. Because years earlier, when he was friends with Carl Sagan, he had asked Carl what he thought of the phenomenon, and Carl said, "There's nothing to it, John." And so John basically dismissed it for many years. So after Stan Groff gave John that chapter, shortly thereafter, John was introduced to a man named Bud Hopkins. And Bud had been a de facto support person for abductees for many years. He was an artist in New York, and he basically was in over his head, and he needed a psychiatrist who could help out. So he turned to John Mack, and John was reluctant. You know, this was not something that was in his wheelhouse. He basically said, anybody who says they've been abducted by aliens has got to be crazy. That's what he told his wife. But he agreed to go meet Bud Hopkins, and Bud handed him a shoebox of letters from people from all over the world. And he said, "John, in my opinion, these people are perfectly sane, but you're the psychiatrist, you decide." So John started to go through the letters, and, you know, he thought that they were crazy, but he got curious what the underlying psychiatric syndrome might be. So he decided to start to study some abductees. And instead of studying them in his office at Harvard, because he was somewhat embarrassed, he set up a makeshift office in his home. And one by one, the abductees came to his home. He went to great lengths to make sure that they stayed separate from each other so that they wouldn't influence each other. And he used his entire psychiatric arsenal. And after he had studied over 200 of them, and these were people from a cross-section of people from different geographical regions, economic and educational levels, people from all levels of life, he was shocked with his initial conclusions. He said, "In my opinion, these people are not lying, and they're not crazy. I know mental illness, and they are not mentally ill." And what he did was he traveled the world. He met with Australian Aborigines, African Bushmen, who corroborated identical stories of what he was hearing back home. And he said, when an African Bushman and an upscale New England housewife are telling the identical story, we have to take the conversation seriously. And so he started to compile his findings in a book, and that became the best-selling book, Abduction. And when Abduction came out, John went on a worldwide media tour, and that's when Harvard heard about it, and they were basically mortified.
Let's back up for a second. You said that he had I had never heard this before, that he had a home office because he sort of knew these crazy people are going to be coming into my office and telling me this story. And he was worried that other people at Harvard would find out, or that they would, they would think, no kidding.
Yeah, he wanted to keep it under the radar for sure.
He knew he was going to take crap for it, didn't he?
I would say yes. He on some level he knew. So, I mean, this was so out of the box for John.
I think a couple things that you said are pretty important, because you read the stuff even years later. Even this article, the article from the Boston Globe about a guy who's fairly sympathetic. You know, the writer's fairly sympathetic to Dr. Mack, but even he thinks the people have to be crazy. But Dr. Mack, so many times I've heard him described as some new age guy, some foo-foo, touchy-feely guy. He was a hardcore scientist, and he did not want to believe this in the beginning.
Totally. That's exactly right. And he did not want to believe it. He really thought, and there's a recording of it right on our website, Make Magic Productions, where you hear John in his own voice say, anybody who believes in that they've been abducted by aliens has got to be crazy. So, yeah, this was not something that he wanted to believe. But, and it was not actually his belief that ultimately it was his, and this is an important distinction, it was his clinical judgment and assessment that came to these conclusions.
So he starts hearing these stories one after another with the same basic tale that is told by abductees. I was taken somewhere. And then he compares notes with Bud Hopkins. At some point, there had to be an epiphany, an epiphanal moment where he goes, "Holy cow, this is actually happening."
Yeah, he was profoundly changed by what he was hearing. And it really shook him up, because you can imagine when you've gone through, by now he was at this point 60 something. So he had gone his entire life with a very particular worldview, which is, this is we live in a physical world. It's basically the Western culture worldview, which is we live in a physical world that we can sense with, we use our five senses to experience, and that's it.
But his view of that change. We'll pick up that story when we come back. Summertime right around the corner, so not too early for Sly and the Family Stone. Take us into the break. We'll be right back with my guest, Denise David Williams, and the story of John Mack right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Denise David Williams about her plans for a film about Dr. John Mack, whose research into alleged alien abductions not only challenged our understanding of reality, but were a direct challenge to the ability of science to figure this stuff out. We'll pick up the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Denise, before the break, we were talking about what must have been some sort of an epiphany, a very tough moment for when he came to realize that this stuff is real. But as you explained, he came to a point after talking to hundreds of the abductees that, A, they're not crazy, and B, it may have really happened. It doesn't leave a whole lot of options there.
Yeah, exactly. So he said someone has to champion these people. And he very courageously, at the risk of losing his standing as a professional, his family, his reputation, he very courageously stood up for them. And that's what makes him such an incredible, heroic figure, in my opinion, that he didn't go looking for this, but once he found it, he was not going to back down, because in his opinion, there was something truthful to the phenomenon, and there was something valuable to the phenomenon that had to do with our spiritual evolution. And that was just too big for him to turn away from.
I'll read you a little bit from a book where we wrote about Dr. Mack. Dr. Mack came to believe that although the scientific method is valuable, even essential, for studying those phenomena that make up the material world as we understand it, the rigid structure of modern science simply can't cut the mustard when it comes to evaluating other realities or those phenomena that seem to straddle the known world and unseen realms. I mean, there was a point not only then he realized, hey, this stuff is real, at least in some level, but he also had to realize that science, as we know it, may not be able to handle it.
Exactly. And that was part of the problem, or that was the heart of the problem that Harvard had. They said to him, John, if only you had said that you had discovered some new psychiatric syndrome, but you're asking us to redefine reality. And, that, I mean, from Harvard's point of view, you could understand where that was like just beyond something that they were willing to accept. But John said that in order to understand the phenomenon, we really do have to expand how we define reality, that we have to use more than our five senses. And it's a phenomenon that's beyond the physical world. So that was extremely controversial, and he took it where other researchers had not gone. Even Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, as I'm sure you know, George, didn't take it to the extent that John did. I mean, originally, he was in agreement with them that this was an experience that was strictly happening in the physical world. But after a couple of years, he came to believe that it was more of a crossover experience, meaning something was crossing over into this dimension, and that because it was happening in that way, it was pretty much impossible to have physical evidence. I mean, there was physical evidence on people's bodies, but actual something tangible from a ship or the things that Bud Hopkins talked about, burnt, scorched earth or implants. John said that was something that was most likely not possible under his definition of how it was occurring.
Yeah, both Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs on this program with this host have talked about that, the need for their colleagues to see some kind of physical evidence. Well, look, you were on the spaceship. Why didn't you bring back a cigarette lighter or a piece of the spaceship? And short of that, people would just not believe it. So it's incredibly courageous for a guy with Dr. Mack's stature to take this on.
Totally. And as I said, to be willing to be ridiculed and mocked. I mean, when Harvard formed the secret committee, they called him in. John was completely unprepared for the hostility that he was met with. I mean, first of all, the head of the committee was a kidney doctor. And the antagonism that they threw at John was completely out of nowhere. So John showed up without legal representation in the beginning, and they really grilled him. I mean, they said to him, look, John, there's nothing new here. These are sleep-related hallucinations, or they're delusions. And they were very close-minded about it. And John said, but this doesn't conform to sleep-related hallucinations. It conforms to a particular narrative, like real experience does. And as you just said, George, the committee said, well, have you found any physical evidence that would justify real experience over hallucinations? And again, you know, John said, I'm a psychiatrist, and the evidence I work with are the words of the subjects, experiential evidence.
I'm betting that, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And then then the committee accused him of working outside of science. And John said, no, I'm working inside of psychiatry. And then the committee said, then your first responsibility is to your patients. So how is confirming their delusions helping your patients? Huh. So it went back and forth like that.
I'm betting that there are probably some medical doctors, the kidney guy you're talking about, who don't even think that psychiatry belongs at the Harvard School of Medicine.
Right, exactly.
Let's back up for a second. How did he get word of the investigation? And who, do you know who started it? I mean, is there a person who came and said, look, I'm embarrassed by this guy. He's off on this book tour promoting this alien abduction stuff, and we got to do something about it.
Yeah, it was the dean of the medical school. His name was Dean Costison. And he and others in the medical school had seen John on his book tour. He was on national television. He was on Oprah, Larry King, the BBC, all over the world, saying in so many words, aliens are real. Then you can imagine how the Harvard Medical School took that, seeing their head of psychiatry saying this.
I can imagine. Oh, my
yeah,
gosh.
Really.
Their heads must have exploded.
Exactly.
But let me back up for even more of a second, and we'll come right back to the Harvard investigation. But he had taken grief before. I mean, the book that he wrote that won him the Pulitzer was controversial, wasn't it?
The psychoanalysis of Lawrence, of T.E. Lawrence.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if it was controversial. I mean, it was. I don't know. I really just know that it won a Pulitzer, and it was pretty highly regarded.
Well, it was controversial because he was psychoanalyzing Lawrence, who had been dead for 30 or 40 years at the time, or 50 years.
Right.
So how long did the investigation go on before Dr. Mack got wind of it, or do you know?
Well, the committee was formed, and John was called to the principal's office, literally to the dean of the heart of medical school, and was informed that the secret committee had been formed and that they were going to be investigating his work. They told him it was a friendly, collegial, academic inquiry, and that, you know, not to worry, we're just kind of curious what you're doing. But in fact, that was not what it was. And it lasted for 14 months, and it was really basically a witch hunt. And they really put him through the ringer.
Did they bring in witnesses or have testimony other than John's?
Well, they brought in witnesses behind John's back. So the whole thing was kind of rigged already. they saw witnesses over the summer, and by then John had an attorney. He was represented by Daniel Sheehan and Eric McLeish. And they found out, his attorneys found out, that behind John's back, they had brought in witnesses and basically had already written up the report even before John got to speak on his own behalf.
This whole thing is conducted in secrecy because, well, you tell me why. I mean, because they're embarrassed by John to begin with. The fact that they would even have to investigate him should be an embarrassment itself.
Exactly. And it what happened was it was leaked to the press. And Alan Dershowitz heard about it. And he was a law professor at Harvard at the time. He was outraged. And he wrote an editorial, and it ended up in the New York Times. And he said, "Isn't it interesting, at an esteemed place of higher learning such as Harvard, that angels are okay, but aliens are not?"
Well, I mean, my gosh, if you don't have academic freedom at a place like Harvard to follow the story wherever you want it to go to investigate what you want to investigate, where could you have it?
Well, you would think that. You would definitely think that. But that really demonstrates how entrenched certain worldviews are and how difficult it is to create a shift. You know, any kind of shift in consciousness in the world. And that's what John was up against, that very entrenched worldview that Harvard represents. And but someone had to do it. And, you know, good for John that he had the courage to.
The fact that it was made public that there was this investigation and then Dershowitz coming forward to defend Dr. Mack, is that sort of the turning point?
It was the turning point of John being ridiculed in the press, of the headlines literally around the world mocking him, the man from outer space, beam me up, you know, Mac.
Tell me some of those. Tell me about some of those.
Oh, beam me up, wacko, macko, the man from outer space, Harvard, beam me up, has he lost his mind, hero or heretic? I mean, this guy was just, it was really kind of sad. And his colleagues thought he was completely committing professional suicide. His wife divorced him.
Oh, really?
Yes. His wife divorced him. And his colleagues thought he had lost his mind.
How were students? Was there anything in the Harvard Crimson? I think that's the name of the newspaper.
Yeah. There was actually something that took place at nearby Stonehill College. There was a Boston Globe reporter. He also had a radio show. His name was Chet Ramo. And he staged a being. All these students at Stonehill College, and a lot of them from Harvard, met in the yard at night. And the whole thing was staged to mock John Mack. And they all wore, like, little alien beanie hats. And this guy, Chet Ramo, who was also, I believe, a physics professor at Stonehill, brought a backpack, and in it was a beer, a sperm sample, and something else, a change of clothes. And he said, "I'm going to wait here till midnight and to have the aliens come and pick me up. You know, and if they don't come and pick me up, then John Mack is crazy." And they were throwing frisbees, and I mean, the whole thing was like one big mock fest. And the next day there was an article in the Boston Globe about John. You know, basically it was mocking John very publicly.
Was there ever a time from what you've learned since that he was ready to hang it up? Maybe I am crazy. I need to get off this ride here and get back to my regular stuff.
You know,
as far as you know,
he pretty much, once he, based on his clinical assessment and judgment, saw what he saw as truthful and valuable, he never turned back. I mean, who among us doesn't have doubts when we're going down a path that's completely new and frightening and possibly, you know, and completely turns us around? But he continued down the path.
Tell me how the investigation ended.
Yeah, it was pretty anticlimactic. He was called into the dean's office after 14 months, and the dean said, "Look, I think we've had enough. If only you had said this was a psychiatric syndrome, John, but you didn't. And I want you, this is literally what the dean said, I want you to consider for one damn moment, John, that you might be wrong." Which is pretty ironic, because John could have said the same about Harvard.
Yeah.
So they basically ended up giving him a slap on the wrist and, you know, releasing him. So it was, but the damage had been done. Yeah, he was pretty much persona non grata at Harvard, and it severely affected his career. And it was extremely, the whole process was extremely disturbing to John. As I said, his family, you know, his wife divorced him, and his colleagues pretty much, you know, thought he was crazy.
Well, you know, I want to reference back to this Boston Globe article that we posted on the Coast website, in which this guy, Alex Beam, is the reporter, and he writes, "I never took much stock in his abductee tales. To me, the experiencers seemed like serial hallucinators or people battling with mental illness. That's pretty much what the world thought, too." Yeah, that's what the world thought. That's what Harvard thought. That's what the kidney doctor thought, except for the people who did the research and actually talked to the abductees and investigated their claims and looked into their cases.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, I can tell you how he was viewed. He took a lot of grief from his professional colleagues, but I remember it hit the UFO world like a tidal wave. Here was a guy whose credentials are impeccable, who had the courage to come out and say this, and it was a major deal. It's still a big deal for somebody with his background and credentials to step forward on this thing. It was a major revelation back in the early 90s.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. And you know, 20 years ago when he started the work, obviously the world was not ready to fully, obviously, to embrace what he was saying. But I do believe that we're much more ready now, 20 years later. And that's why the story has come back around, and we're giving it life, and we're carrying the torch, you know, for what John stood for and what he basically gave everything up for. And really all he was saying is keep an open mind. Keep an open mind. Isn't it possible that we're not alone in the universe? Isn't it possible that we're connected to something greater?
Do you have a sense of where this research was going? As you said, in the beginning, he sort of sympathetic to Bud Hopkins' views about the physical reality of these abductions, and then it changed, and it became a much broader understanding about the sort of the nature of reality itself. Do you have a sense from reading his papers and speaking to friends and relatives and colleagues about what he thought was happening when these abductions take place? You know, what was happening for the people involved?
Yeah. Wow. It's pretty complex.
Yeah.
So, and also it of course depends on who you talk to.
Sure.
But generally speaking, there was something very traumatic that was happening to the abductees. This is an incredible analogy that John used that I think is very provocative. He said that when a parent takes a baby to the doctor to get vaccinated, from the baby's level of consciousness, it's traumatizing. You know, it's getting stuck with a needle, and it's scary, and it screams, and it cries. But from the doctor's point of view and the parent's higher perspective, it's something for the baby's well-being. And he used that analogy for what the experiencers were going through. You know, that something was happening, but it had a greater purpose. I mean, something terrifying was happening. Now, there in one of the cases in abduction, there's a guy named Peter. Peter was on Oprah with John, and he was very brave, and he went public way before anyone else was willing to go public. And what Peter said was, that although the physical experiences he was having, and he had some extreme experiences, being they took semen from him, the aliens took semen from him several times and violated his body in all different kinds of ways and was terrifying to him. But what he came to say about that was that the physical body was the way to break through to a spiritual transformation. And he actually said the reason it was terrifying is because it was beyond our grasp. It was beyond our definition of reality. In other words, if you expanded to a greater sense of reality, it actually wasn't that frightening. So
I'll tell you what, Denise, yeah. We're going to have to take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the nature of reality, how Dr. John Mack saw it, and then we'll get into discussing about your movie project and the promise that it held in the beginning and then the problems you ran into.